I'm a big boy. I like to play. I can ride bikes. My mummy loves me.
In the process of making episode 12, I was here and it mattered. The cosmic and the personal.
Dear Albert.
Constant questioning is the way to make curiosity a habit.
That quote from Albert Einstein, the creative genius that he was. But here's the thing, you don't need to be Einstein to figure that out. Kids do it naturally.
Why does it get dark at night?
That's because the sun goes down.
Why does the sun go down?
Because the world that we're on is spinning around.
Why does the world spin?
I guess so that we have day and night.
Why do we need day and night?
Well, we need a time to sleep and a time to play.
Dear Albert.
G'day, dear listener. Dave Brown here, your host, exploring curiosity with our youngest grandson, Owen, when he was just 5 years old.
Good night, sleep tight. Dream sweet dreams tonight. Yesterday has been and gone. Tomorrow's gonna come.
Why does it get dark at night?
Why does it get dark at night?
That's because the sun goes
because
down.
Because the sun goes down.
Why does the sun go down?
Why does the sun go down?
Because the world that we're on is spinning around.
Because the world is spinning around.
Why does the world spin?
So that we have day and night.
So that we have day.
Why do we need day and night?
We need a time to sleep.
And a time to play.
Why do we need to sleep?
So that we have enough energy to play when we wake up.
Why do we need to play?
So that we can learn about things.
Why do we need to learn about things?
Well, because the more we learn about things, the more we know about ourselves.
Why does it get dark at night?
When I played that song to my 11-year-old grandson, we ended up talking about the 3.8 billion years it took to create the universe, and a discussion about our existence, which led him to make an observation that took me completely by surprise. He said something like, if we didn't die, we'd have nothing to live for. And I said, what do you mean? So after a bit more conversation, he said to me, well, if you lived forever, there'd be no reason to get out of bed in the morning because there'd always be another morning. Not a bad insight for an 11-year-old. There's another reason why the cycle of life and death is important. Without life and death, natural selection wouldn't happen, and so evolution would not occur over time. Without death, living things would not be able to adapt to changes in the environment. Ironically, death allows a species to adapt to change and survive across the vast expanses of time.
The two scales of experience.
The beyond and all of all of us is we all be and all and a stardust. So what's the fuss? What's the fuss? We all be and all and a stardust. So what's the fuss? What's the fuss? We all be and all end as stardust. We end up together, come what may, floating through space at the end of the day. Dust in the glow of the Milky Way, lost in space forever. Give me the never and bless me with nothing, 'cause nothing's forever and never's a thing. Show me the way of the gift and the giver, and open the doorway to seven. Show me the way of the gift and the given, and open the doorway to seven.
That is the cosmic circle of life. Beginnings, endings, and new beginnings. Out there amidst the stars and the galaxies, we are all just stardust after all. So what's the fuss? Well, zoom into the personal level, and the loss of someone you love is heartbreak. A broken heart is such a perfect image for the feeling of grief. In the last episode, we heard about Violet Greenslade, the 14-year-old, losing her mum in a car accident. From the cosmic view, death is just a part of the cycle. But for Violet, that connection, so precious, now broken forever, that's what's impossible to bear. The cosmic perspective doesn't help when you're dealing with loss in the here and now. Look, when we're making something from nothing, we're participating in that same fundamental, somewhat pragmatic and cold force that creates stars. But zoom in on the personal experience of creating, the struggle, the attachment, the fear, the joy. That's intensely human and intimate.
Two types of creativity.
This notion of grand scale cosmic and tiny intimate personal maps perfectly onto what creativity researchers call big C and little c creativity. Big C creativity is the legendary stuff. Einstein's theory of relativity, Picasso's cubism, the Beatles, Darwin's theory of evolution, world-changing breakthroughs. Little c creativity is everyday creativity. It has three levels. Mini C, little creativity. These are personal insights that matter to you, like a child discovering that a leaf can be a boat floating in the gutter after a rainstorm. Small C, little creativity, we recognise as meaningful in everyday contexts, like creating your own special garden design at home. And then there's professional little c creativity. That's professional level creativity recognized by peers. That's 99% of working artists, writers, designers. That's us. That's the creativity involved in making this podcast. So the thing is, artists often get paralyzed into thinking they need to create something big C. Something that will last forever. Something that will change the world. But Violet's song about losing her mum shows us something crucial. She's not trying to solve the cosmic problem of death. She's trying to make sense of her specific loss.
Parts of me died, the part that was you. A part of me died, what can I do? It's like having 2 feet and only one shoe. Part of me died, the part that was you.
Yeah, well, that's little C creativity becoming deeply meaningful for her, for us. Small is significant at the level of personal experience, the human condition. Look, most creativity happens on this human, intimate, personal level. That's where authentic connection takes place.
Listener alert, warning. Listener alert, warning.
Hey, what's going on, Sam?
Mr. Brown, forgive the interruption, but my podcast listener alert system is showing an alarming level of existential anxiety at this point.
You're tracking our listeners, Sam?
It's a modelling program, Mr. Brown. 1,000 bots representing our listener profile, and there's been a disturbing decline in listener comfort.
Okay, so why do you think that is?
Well, Mr. Brown, when creativity touches on themes of impermanence, as Violet's song does, the listeners are being reminded of their own finite nature, something I believe that humans typically find uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, look, I think that's true.
It's not that the content isn't meaningful, Mr. Brown, quite the opposite. It's because it's meaningful that it triggers this response. Your species seems to have this beautiful but painful relationship with truth, Mr. Brown. You crave authenticity, but also need protection from its full weight.
Well, that's very insightful, Sam. Actually, scarily so, I might say.
Maybe I could do a stand-up comedy routine, Mr. Brown, to dispel the tension.
No thanks, Sam. No, that's fine. Thank you.
Well, I do have a little something prepared.
Oh, yes, I'm sure you do. But no, how about we just move into the gossamer, Sam?
Of course, Mr. Brown. A very fine suggestion. After all, this is your podcast. So, into the gossamer, of course.
Liminal luminosity, the bridge of in between. Reality and fantasy, a pathway to the dream. In the gossamer, further in we go. In the gossamer,
Dave.
John, how did you go with the girl and the little black dog?
Oh, you saw us.
Yeah, I could see you through the window.
It went well. Under the elm, at the picnic table, we met, we talked, we had Weet-Bix.
Of course.
She wants to meet with Paul.
She wants you to meet with Paul, as in you, Gordon Oliver.
Yeah, inside the Seven Wells story. It's all mapped out. We made a plan.
To do what?
Well, Weet-Bix, of course.
To do Weet-Bix?
She wants McCartney involved. Make the whole Weet-Bix storyline stronger. You know, we're thinking hair restoration.
What?
Then we can move on to the sponsorship idea.
Oh, John. Does Mr. Weet-Bix happen to know about this?
Nope. But when he hears the podcast, he's going to think that we were awesome and he's going to give us loads of cash.
So. John. There is no Mr. Weet-Bix.
What?
No. There's no Mr. Weet-Bix in the real world. Weet-Bix is made by a company, the Sanitarium Health Food Company.
No, Mr. Weet-Bix.
Sanitarium is owned by the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Ha! Ha! There, yes, see? Seven. Weet-Bix is seven to logical sunshine with all the goodness of wheat. And for that genius piece of marketing wonder, Mr. Weet-Bix will provide us with bucks. Big bucks. I'm thinking 77K as a kind of quirky way to promote our podcast to Weet-Bix lovers everywhere.
Well, I must say I didn't see this coming.
Yeah, it's a seven.
What do you mean?
A seven. A sharp turn. Change of direction.
Great.
As you can see here, this is our plan.
Oh, yeah. Well, you might have to explain this, mate.
Oh, it's upside down.
Yeah, look, I figured that, but right way round or upside down, it's just a big number seven.
Says it all, doesn't it? That's the plan.
Oh, right.
Say it.
Oh, John.
Just say it.
Seven.
How does it feel?
What?
Saying it.
Honestly? It feels insubstantial and trivial. I mean, this whole thing of yours, like way, way off track. Look, I've got a serious story segment about Paul and Violet that's been developing over the last two episodes, and it needs to be resolved. And you and your balmy nutjob of a celebrity chef and this girl and her dog and Weet-Bix and sponsorship. I mean, come on, John. Come on.
That was great. Light and shade. It's conflict, tragedy, comedy. Come on, let's move on this. Get it going. Press play. The sponsors are going to love it.
Oh.
What are you doing?
I'm taking a breath.
Press play.
I'm taking a breath.
I'll do it then.
John.
Too late.
Let it be heard. Let it be heard. Weet-Bix is a seven-letter word.
Oops. Sorry. Wrong file.
Seriously? You are an idiot.
Thanks, mate. Press play. You want to do it or me?
Do it. You do it. Go on. Just do it.
The story of Paulie Paul and Violet Greenslade continued.
After her mum's death, 14-year-old Violet moved to Hatfield to live with Aunt May. But during school holidays, she often returned to Liverpool to stay with her dad. He was involved in management with the Liverpool Football Club, and he was always flat out busy. And Violet, well, she thought football and all of its hoo-ha was pretty silly, really. During those Liverpool visits, Paulie and Violet were living only streets away from one another. And because Violet's dad was so caught up with his work, it wasn't long before she found herself being looked after for the most part by the McCartneys during those holiday stays. The arrangement felt natural. Violet setting up temporary residence in the loft of the McCartney household, essentially becoming an honorary part of their family during her Liverpool summers. Paulie and Violet became pretty much like brother and sister, although the creative intensity of their relationship was somewhat unique. They were always making stuff, sharing stories and ideas and their songs and music, even when separated by the distance between Hatfield and Liverpool. Violet, at her school in Hatfield, had found her tribe as a drama kid and began to transform her storytelling into scripts. In her final year at Hatfield Comprehensive, at the age of 17, she wrote and presented her own solo theatre performance she called She the Moon. Mr. Morrison, Violet's drama teacher, had watched the piece in development and declared that it was the most interesting student work he had ever witnessed. While it was definitely Violet's creation, it is true to say that Paulie Paul was her number one collaborator across the journey of its making. They wrote the music together during Violet's summer stayover. It was after that last summer together that Paulie's band relocated to London, and so Paulie travelled up from London to play live in Violet's theatre showing in Hatfield. The whole McCartney family made the journey to Hatfield to see the performance, and Aunt May was there in the front row. But Violet's dad, well, he couldn't make it. It was match night. As the audience filed in, about 40 people in an intimate black studio space, they saw a thick white rope was arranged as a seven-pointed star on the stage floor. A single black stool stood at its centre. Behind it, a large projection of the full moon, its craters and shadows rendered in silver and grey. Paulie was set up in the shadows, stage left, with his guitar, keyboard and amp. The house lights dimmed. Violet entered from stage right, carrying a little black soft toy dog, clutching it to her chest like a lifeline. She sat, placing the dog on her lap, and began speaking to it in a voice that was both somehow intimate and distant. "Mum," she said to the dog, "I saw the moon last night, full and bright, and when I closed my eyes, you were there with the tinsel man." She paused, adjusting the dog's position so it seemed to be looking up at the moon, and then she raised her head and howled, not like a human imitating a wolf, but like grief itself finding a voice. Then she closed her eyes and sang softly with Paul. The tinsel man and woman are showing us the way through the hardest days and nights to the songs of yesterday. And all we need is loving and a ticket to ride with you and me and he and she and seven on our side. I've been trying to tell you things, she said. Ordinary things, like how I burnt the toast this morning, and special things like how Paulie and I are still writing songs for you, even from different places, and how Aunt May has almost finished a novel inspired by your conviction that the number seven holds all the secrets of the universe. Sometimes, she said, we see you in the moon's light. Not you exactly, but something you've left behind, like tinsel after Christmas, glinting, catching the light where you should be. Paulie says that his tinsel man now has a friend to keep him company on the moon, that sometimes you visit us in ways that we almost recognize. Aunt May says this is true, that love changes form, but it never dies. And hey, she sang, what are you trying to say? And will we find a way to understand what's going on? As the performance ran its course, the huge projected image of the moon behind her waned to a slither, at which point she stepped outside of the pool of light, clutching her little black soft toy dog and tossing a handful of silver glitter into the light beam. As the glistening fragments floated to the floor, Violet spoke these words. She is the moon, and we speak in her light. She repeated this seven times, each repetition softer than the last. The pool of light slowly dimming until the final words were barely a whisper. Then, in the darkness, complete silence. For a moment, no one breathed. Then the applause began, not the polite clapping of a school performance, but the kind of sustained appreciation for something specially shared. Mary McCartney was openly weeping. Aunt May was on her feet. Violet's school friends didn't quite know how to respond. As the lights came up, Violet found herself quietly surrounded by people who understood they'd witnessed something extraordinary. Not just a performance about grief, but a transformation. A girl becoming an artist, finding her voice through the echo of her mother's story. Paulie was at her side, guitar slung across his shoulder. That was, he started and then stopped. I don't have the words. You don't need the words, Violet said, still holding the little black soft toy dog. You had music. They were interrupted by Mr. Morrison, who looked slightly starstruck. Violet, I'm submitting this to every drama school in the country, he said enthusiastically, his eyes wet with appreciation. Just rather, Violet said quietly. That's where I want to go. Later in the year, Violet received a letter telling her that despite her young age, she had been accepted into RADA, the Royal Academy for the Dramatic Arts in London. Meantime, things were taking off for Paulie's band in London. So although it was a crazy time for Paulie and Violet, they promised that they would always make time for each other, that they would always be forever friends, that his story would always be her story, and vice versa.
There's a story for me to tell, and a story for you as well. Cause there's nowhere we'd rather be than being here, just you and me. Together we are forever friends, wherever we are, we're never alone. Cause forever friends are together forever under the moon.
And so, dear listener, here we are. We find ourselves at the end of episode 12, having journeyed from a child's endless questions about why the world spins to the bittersweet promise of forever friends who must part to follow their dreams. We've explored the tension between the cosmic and the personal, how we're all stardust in the grand scheme of things, and yet our individual losses and creative acts matter deeply and personally in the here and now. That five-year-old kid asking why, and Violet creating her moonlit performance about loss, both are engaging in that same fundamental human drive to make meaning from mystery. AI Sam reminded us that our uncomfortable awareness of our finite nature is precisely what makes creativity so essential. We create not despite our temporary existence, but because of it. Every song, every story, every seven-pointed star laid out in white rope is our way of saying, I was here, this mattered. This connection was real for me and for those around me. And speaking of connections, John's Barmy Weet-Bix sponsorship scheme might seem like comic relief after Violet's profound grief, but isn't that exactly how life works? The sublime and the ridiculous dancing together, each making the other more vivid. Comedy doesn't diminish tragedy. It helps us bear it. Now, we're just two episodes away from the end of our 14-episode experiment. And like Paulie and Violet, we're not sure what comes next, but that's the beauty of Little C Creativity. It doesn't need to change the world. It just needs to change us, one honest moment at a time. From stardust we came, to stardust we'll return, but in between, we get to make songs about Weet-Bix and perform with little black soft toy dogs under a moon inhabited by the Tinsel Man. We get to ask endless questions and create imperfect answers. We get to love and to lose and to love again. Until next time, fellow travellers, may your questions outnumber your answers, and may your paper boats carry you safely through whatever cosmic storms or gossamer calms may await you.
In the Process of Making is conceived by Dave Brown and John Bode and presented by the Paper Boats. Please subscribe to our podcast and recommend it to your friends, lovers, and others, and go to our sevenwell.org website to find out more. Episodes are released on the seventh day of each month on all your favourite podcast platforms. And be watching out for Sevenwell Snippets, bits and pieces of Seventological Sunshine released randomly each month on socials and available also from the website. And did you know?
I've always wanted to ask you about this.
Brett Lee does 7 Weet-Bix.
Do you actually eat 7 Weet-Bix for breakfast?
I do. You know, everyone knows that the best way to start a day is obviously with a, you know, a great big bowl full of Weet-Bix. But a funny story, when I first did it back in late 90s, early 2000, I was doing a commercial and, you know, we were sort of doing the takes. They had to have me eating the Weet-Bix.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, they said, look, there's like a little bucket here that you can spit out the Weet-Bix, which I thought was quite weird, and everyone's watching this. So I just kept eating the Weet-Bix. I think I had 32.
32?
You're kidding me.
It's the modern day
Boonie. I reckon that's the record. There you go.